if you're the one who has to make the call, the buck stops with you, as they say, you know, make the final call, then yes, that needs to drive you. You have to be able to say, not even, I know I'm right. It's like, I think this is the direction we need to go in. Look, in reality, and I think you'll get this given your background, do we ever really know we're right?
Welcome to the Jason Mark Campbell Business Podcast, where we explore what it really takes to sell, lead, and grow a business, and ultimately, live well. In every episode, we go beyond tactics to discover how entrepreneurs and leaders across different sectors are growing with love, impact, and integrity. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Jason Mark Campbell Podcast. Very excited to have Marielle Wilkins, who's going to be joining me as the CEO and founder of Paravis Partners, an executive, coach, and trusted advisor to C-suite and senior leaders. And she helps actually people when it comes to becoming real leaders while hosting the Coaching Real Leaders podcast, which is published by Harvard Business Review. She's the co-author of Own the Room, Discover Your Signature Voice to Master Your Leadership Presence, and her book, which has just been released, Leadership Unblocked, Breakthrough the Belief That Limits Your Potential. It's just been released in October 2025. She's been actually helping leaders across C-suites, integral roles, big organizations, and we're so excited that she's going to be sharing some of these things that whether you're just getting started or have a lot of experience in a leadership role, what are the common blocks that hold us back and hold the company back from the scale, the growth, and the results we're trying to bring forward? I know I am in for a treat to see how I can do better within my own leadership. Marielle, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much, Jason. It's a pleasure to be here.
I got to start with one of the assumptions I would have from somebody who's in a C-suite position, in a leadership position. Do you find that sometimes it's hard for us to look in the own mirrors and admit our flaws? Or are you seeing leadership are quite open to seeing, like, maybe I do have blocks?
I would say it's actually quite challenging to do that for anyone, but particularly I think for folks who haven't necessarily had to on their way to being successful. They've been successful in spite of having to do that. And so a lot of times it is difficult to do, not only because there's resistance to doing it, but there's so much happening around us that we need to be paying attention to that we're not taking the time or just the attention of focusing on how we might be contributing to some of the issues that we have.
That makes a lot of sense. We might rise to a leadership position in spite of the blocks, which kind of begs me the question, before getting into the blocks, have you noticed what are some of the things that most leaders might have as a baseline that makes it more likely that they rise to a leadership position?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the biggest thing is that they have an ability to get things done, right? They have an ability to drive to results. And so they get promoted on that ability. Oftentimes it's a technical ability, so they might be an expert in a particular way, or it's just an ability to drive to certain outcomes, usually that are task-oriented, and that carries them to a certain point because it's very much rewarded and valued by those who are above them, but it doesn't necessarily lead to what it takes to be able to lead at scale or be able to lead people or be able to lead with a purpose and vision.
Well, I know you've worked with really large companies. I'm working with a company that's, you know, like in a seven-figure range, right? We're just establishing a leadership team. And I have a temptation being in a leadership position when I am facing the lack of execution. Things aren't going as fast as I want to jump in. I want to get my hands dirty. And I see that as a superpower. And I have a feeling that this might be one of my bad habits as I get more and more experience as a leader in an organization. So I'd love for you to unpack that tendency.
Yeah. I mean, Jason, I don't know if you follow any, like, so you used the word superpower. So I'm going to go from there. I happen to be partnered with someone who loves all the Marvel movies. So through osmosis, I've learned all about them. And one thing that I learned along the way is that, you know, every hero, whether it's Superman or Incredible Hulk or whatever, I know I'm messing them up at this point. Yes, they might have a superpower, but it's also the other side of their shadow. And so one of the things to be aware of, as you said, is maybe your superpower is to jump in and to get things done, but you also might want to look at and what ways might that be getting in the way in terms of the leadership role that you hold, right? And we all have both what we can consider blockers, but beliefs or mindsets that may help us in certain situations, that may help us get to where we want to get to, but that may not be contextually relevant for the situation we're in at a particular point in time. And that's where it's really important to pay attention.
You know, given that my history of what I love speaking about is mostly sales, right? I wrote my own stuff on sales. I often speak about how we have misconceptions, particularly from media, of what a good salesperson is. Like, we'll watch a movie like The Wolf of Wall Street. You'll see Leonardo DiCaprio playing the role of Jordan Belfort on the phone saying the perfect thing to get somebody to say, yeah, I'll consider buying this penny Scott talk, right? And I find what happens is we start thinking, oh, that's what I need to model to be good in sales. Or you start thinking, well, to be good at sales, I need to be manipulative and an a-hole. I need to be, you know, really have the gift of the gab or I have no chance. And that's a huge misconception we have in the world of sales. And I'm trying to debunk that. I have a feeling that when we look at superheroes and we look at the leaders, we're probably not always looking at the best role models. That gives us a preconception of how we should be going forward with leaders. Have you noticed some of the most, you know, maybe bad examples of leadership that we should actually maybe not try to model, and maybe some better examples that we should be looking at?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think one of the issues is that when we look at individuals in front of us and we say, oh my gosh, you know, that's the way that they became successful, therefore that's what I need to do. It's actually reinforced by those leaders as well. You know, oftentimes what you'll see is individuals who promote others because they are acting exactly the way that they act, which can be a huge risk for an organization, particularly if the way that they are leading is toxic or unproductive. So one of the things that I think is really important is that as you mature as a leader is to start defining what is your own way of leading, right? What is your own footprint going to be? How are you defining success from an organizational standpoint, from a company standpoint, from a team standpoint, and from a personal standpoint? And then work backwards from there to say, if that's what I'm defining in terms of my leadership success, how do I need to behave? What actions do I need to take? And then drilling back from there, what is the mindset or the beliefs that I need to have?
You've obviously been working in this field for a long time. You've seen a lot of these people with these different blocks, which is probably the catalyst towards the recent book. I noticed there's 7 blockers. I see that these are in a certain order. And for those who aren't aware, definitely pick up a copy of the book. We'll put a link in the show notes so you guys can go through this. But I wanted to speak about maybe the biggest perpetrators in leadership when it comes. I mean, I've shared about my whole like, hey, I'll jump in and get it done. That's maybe one of my blockers. I'd be curious to know what are the more common ones that you typically see.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, the 7 are the most common one. And I would say that they're kind of, you know, I call them close cousins, meaning they are equally as risky to have. And they also have some overlap with each other. So the way that I identify these, I actually became curious around what were the beliefs that were holding some of my clients back. And so I looked across over 300 of my clients from the past 20 years. I looked at a sample of the overall universe of whom I had worked with and looked to see, were there any commonalities? And lo and behold, there were. And these were the 7 that rose to the top. So that doesn't mean that these are the only ones. And in fact, what I hope that people will take away from the book is that they can then discover that maybe the 7 is a starting point for them, but that there might be others that they have that aren't necessarily listed. But the 7, you know, quite frankly, are agnostic. I've seen them across different age groups, different sectors, size of organizations, gender, race. But what they are very common in is that often they have, again, really led to somebody being successful or being effective up until a certain point. And where they start to impede the individual is in being able to really tap into the full potential that they could have as a leader. And what it requires then is really shifting or expanding their mindset. Not to say that those beliefs, the 7 ones that I name, which I'm sure we'll go through, are bad. That it's just that they're not relevant for the particular situation or context that they're in at that point.
It makes me think, because you mentioned earlier how a lot of our superpowers also ends up being our double-edged sword, right?
Mm-hmm.
When I look at these blockers, do they actually end up being enablers at different stages of the company?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, if you think about one of the ones that you mentioned earlier on, which is I need to be involved, right? When you said you have this superpower of really being involved, well, guess what? You know, I have that one too, by the way, right? And I'm probably for both of us, it was an enabler in terms of our ability to do really well earlier on in our career, I mean, if I were coaching somebody who was early career and they were an individual contributor and they had a particular task at hand, I would say, yes, you want to hold on to that belief. You do need to be involved. You need to be overly involved. You need to be triple, quadrupling, checking what you're doing, right? The issue is when you need to scale and you're now managing others or you're managing multiple teams and you literally do not have the physical capacity to be involved in all the things, it creates a limitation for the rest of the organization. And you also start becoming an enabler in terms of cultivating learned helplessness on your teams. Because if you get so involved and you're involved in everything, guess what's going to happen? At a certain point, they're going to say, I'm not even going to try to figure it out because he's going to figure it out anyway. So why should I be involved, right? And so you have to really think about then, what is your responsibility as a leader? And is the belief that you're carrying enabling behaviors that align with those responsibilities or working against them?
As you say this, I'm just thinking of every interactions I've had in the last 30 days and like, okay, where have I been enabling the kinds of behaviors I'm trying to work against in the organization?
Yeah. And that's a great question to ask yourself, right? That's where it starts, you know, because you start taking agency over what you are doing and starting to scratch below the surface around, well, what's driving that behavior? I mean, Jason, the reason why I even became curious about this is because, look, I'm a very action-oriented, probably biased to action person. And so in all of my coaching, it was always like, okay, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? Let's jump to action. And what I would notice is that they would do the things, right? They would do the actions, but then they would come right back to where they started. And so I was like, something's not sticking. It's not making the change in action or the change in skill or the change in behavior sustainable. There has to be something else that's driving it. Well, what drives it is our internal operating system, right? And our internal operating system is our mindset. And so if the mindset is not aligned with the behavior or the action, it's not going to stick. It's going to break down at some point. And so that's when I started saying, okay, well, let's look at how we can shift the mindset to align with the behavior that you believe you need to achieve the outcomes that you want to have. So it's still very outcomes driven, but what it requires is an integration and an alignment between all the systems that we have, our mindset, our skill set, our behaviors that then lead to the results.
I find it funny because you mentioned mindset and then like I was a part of Mind Valley. I'm all about mindset. I've promoted meditation. I still work for breathwork industry. So I know how important mindset is. My leadership mind and at the same time reading at the blocker is funny because we kind of went down one step, which is, okay, we're trying to deal with, I need to be involved as a bit of a blocker I'm facing. So we're trying to go back and see how we change our behavior so that we empower others. You start saying, well, you give the prescription, it doesn't work. You have to work on mindset. And my first thing is like, oh, working on mindset takes time, but I need this to be done now.
Which is another one of the blockers.
It's just the next blocker on the list. And I was like, I'm terrible.
Right. Well, I mean, why is that? Because look, I mean, this is, you know, we resist it. We resist the change. And I love the fact that you're familiar with all the Mind Valley stuff and all that, because I didn't make any of this stuff up, right? I mean, this type of framework and what I'm sharing, I will not take credit for it at all. It has been taught in the schools of psychology. It's been taught in wisdom schools for eons, right? And the part that gets me is, why is it not being taught in leadership circles? Why is it not making its way into where we spend an enormous, enormous part of our lives, which is in the workplace? And I think there's been an approach of thinking about it in terms, you know, particularly during the pandemic, like, oh, we should all be mindful. We should all be mindful. But what does that really mean, right? It's not just about, I mean, I'm a practitioner, I meditate and all the things. But if you're not understanding that this is really about expanding the capacity of your mind so that you can deal with the complexity of what's in front of you, then you're kind of missing the point. And mindfulness to me in this particular arena is the ability to be present enough that you recognize that you have a choice in how to respond at any given moment, right? The issue is most people don't recognize that they have a choice in how they respond, and that what drives the response is the belief. And so my hope is that people understand that the one thing you have control over is yourself. And you can have control over your body, but you certainly have control over this. It takes a lot of work to get there, or it's a path to get there. But boy, once you can tap into it, as I'm sure you can attest to, it can really not only open up doors for you, but more importantly, Jason, I think it enables you to just lead with a little bit more ease, right? The challenges don't go away, but the way that you can approach them will feel different and you can experience it differently.
So in the role that I'm at now, I come in as a general manager, and I'm kind of in parallel on the leadership team with the founder, who's this visionary artist type person. And so they hold a lot of sway, and they're definitely the types of person. They have this vision. They've seen it so clear in their head, and they're like, I need it to be birthed now. And so I feel for this one, I have to be the counterweight. I'm the one who has to come in and being like, oh yeah, they're all important, but we need to prioritize. We can only focus on three this quarter. And then it's like, you have to create these constraints, but it's created like this ripple of peace inside the organization, because now people are like, oh, we don't have 21 priorities that need to be done now.
Yeah, because I mean, the I need it done now belief, you know, what it leads to is toxic productivity, right? You're being productive, but it's a toxic productivity. And what does that mean? It's doing things at any cost, you know, without any filter. And what gets me around that one, because I also have that belief is very strong, is it actually ends up being counterproductive. And so the very thing that you were wanting, which is to get things done, it runs counter to that, right? It dilutes the effort. It drains the energy. And so when I frame it that way, or my clients start seeing that the very thing that they want, they're actually working against by holding that belief, that's when they recognize, huh, maybe I should go about it a little bit differently than I have.
I find this is one of the areas I've seen this most prevalent is when you think a tech solution can solve all of your problem and you want to deploy it now. And I've noticed when you take a step back and you actually take the time to be mindful, think about it, you start realizing, wait, we don't even have a tech issue here. What the hell are we doing? We're just trying to put a Band-Aid here. So yeah, which kind of leads into the next one. I mean, I'm going to be going through this list with you.
Let's go. Let's do them all.
We got, I know I'm right. I would say this one, it's very interesting because I would consider myself someone that I usually start with, I am wrong. And the problem I often have is that when it comes to me making an ultimate decision, I often try to get a consensus. It's a muscle I need to work on to being like, I'm right and this is the decision and I hold firm by it, because I feel like I'm never confident that I'm 100% right.
Yeah. So we'll come back to that when we look at the next one, which is I can't make a mistake, because what you're what you're describing, my hypothesis would be that, you know, there's a little voice in the back of your mind that says, I can't make a mistake, right? That leads you to then sort of check with everyone, make sure everybody's aligned. Are we sure? Should we make the decision? I don't know. Right? The I know I'm right is actually counter to that. The I know I'm right is like, there's no way I'm making a mistake, right? Like, I don't need to check with anybody. I know what we need to do. And they're sort of blinders. And so it also leads to kind of rushing through things, because we don't need to kind of check with everyone. I know the way to go. And, you know, what's interesting in this one, Jason, is I have a soft spot for people with this belief, actually. This is one that I, quite frankly, had plagued me for quite some time as well. What's uncanny about individuals who have this belief, a lot of times they actually are right. They actually are right. They have this uncanny ability of seeing around corners, right? I describe in the book, I start off by sharing my own personal story of one of my struggles, you know, my first like really, really senior leadership position, where this was the belief that kind of wreaked havoc, okay? And what was interesting, I don't actually share this in the book, but what was interesting is my boss, who was the CEO, when I finally said, you know, I've had it, like I'm leaving, I'm resigning, he said, you know, Muriel, I know that what you're driving to is the right thing. I know you have the answer, but you're like 2 or 3 years ahead of your time. And so what I missed there is understanding that the point here was not about just driving to my answer. It was about getting everybody else aligned, that was my job as the leader, right? Getting folks to buy in and understanding what the organization was ready for. I did have the answer, but they weren't ready for the answer that I had. And so I needed to come up. And so that was a reframe, right? My reframe was, what is the strategy or what is the answer that is right for this organization? Rather than, I know I'm right, I have the answer, right? That little reframe, if I had applied it back then, may have changed things. If anything, it would have helped me be much less frustrated than what I was, okay? So part of it is understanding that this isn't about, you know, because a lot of times I hear, well, you shouldn't have this, you should just be nice and listen to people. Maybe you'll come up with a different answer. That's actually not always the case, okay? It's more about, is having that as the mentality, as the mindset aligned again with the results that you're trying to get as a leader and with the organization?
This went in a direction I wasn't expecting, and I'm so happy about it. And as you shared this, I couldn't help but think about, and I'll quote my Mindvalley time as well, the founder CEO of Vishen Lakhiani, he was someone that I know I'm always right. And when you start tapping into like the metaphysical and having an openness to spirituality, he would often say like, my intuition is what tells me we're going into this way. I can't explain it right now, and would bulldoze in some capacity into a new direction. And the organization would resist that a lot. And we'd be like, what's going on? But gosh, the strike rate that he would have as making the right decision was uncanny. So I almost feel like the I know I'm right is a quality that you have to embody or at least nurture in some capacity as a leader, because you're there to make decisions in some capacity.
That's right. You know, and look, I think it also depends situationally, right? If you're the one who has to make the call, right? Like the call stops with you, the buck stops with you, as they say, you know, make the final call, then yes, that needs to drive you. You have to be able to say, not even, I know I'm right. It's like, I think this is the direction we need to go in. Look, in reality, and I think you'll get this given your background, do we ever really know we're right? You know?
I always overthink it.
You know, as far as I know, nobody actually ever really, really knows we're right. We're putting a stake in the ground. We're placing a high bet that our answer is the answer. We don't really know, you know? I mean, we can model the heck out of it, and it gives us a very informed decision. So that belief in and of itself is not grounded in reality. You know, unless you can time travel and look back and know that that's what's going to happen, actually, right? Like, you can be well informed. And so there's even with a lot of leaders who do have that intuition, that gut check or the experience, them being able to even say, I think this is the way we need to go in, or mentally, that's the way they're thinking, right? This is the direction we're going in, but I'm holding it loosely. I'm open to the fact that there might be alternatives, because the danger is that, you know, even with somebody who's very visionary and they're like, I know this is the way and the strike rate has been high, what happens when they don't strike? Are they willing to course correct? And we have seen so many organizations who do not course correct, who do not change strategy because they are holding on so tightly to this, I knew I was right back then, and by God, I'm not going to change my mind on that, right? So yes, you absolutely need to have conviction, but conviction doesn't mean chokeholding the answer.
And I guess in some way, if you've put that stick in the ground, you've decided to plow in that direction, you've mobilized the resources, so the chances of it creating a fruit at the end is not a 50-50 at that point. You've dedicated the resources, but I guess you just have to, at some point, you have to be like, oh, wait. We need to look at the data. So it sounds like flexibility of changing your mind is probably the much better muscle to work on if you being right all the time is something that you already have, which to have that muscle, I guess you have to be open with the fact that you can make mistakes.
I mean, and what does that do? It makes you a little bit more human. Okay. And the rap that folks who have this type of belief who drives them is people find them unrelatable. Right? They sort of come off as missing the connection, the relatability, because they're so task-oriented on just getting to the result and getting to the answer, or balancing that with the fact that as a leader, actually your job as a leader is to balance two things. It's to balance the task, the things that need to get done, and to balance people. If you don't have people in the equation, I'm sorry, you're not a leader, because who are you leading? Who are you leading, right? So if you want to be an individual contributor, or there's sometimes people realize, gosh, maybe I should have just stayed as like an individual contributor, subject matter expert, and I just drill down on this thing and that's it. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's no shade in it, right? But if you are leading, which literally is mobilizing people and resources to get to a particular result through tasks that need to be done, you can't just focus on the task. You're missing half of the equation. So the math isn't mapping, right? When you do that, and that's when, you know, there are consequences to that. Sometimes the consequences don't hurt enough, okay? And sometimes they do. And when they do is what I'm trying to mitigate people from getting to, and also when I end up working with individuals because they don't like the consequences, right?
Well, I want to speak of a stereotypical leader who wants to keep a divine, godly aura about them. They don't want to be humanly relatable. They don't want to admit mistakes. The idea of just getting in front of the entire organization and say, guys, I made a mistake. I was going the wrong way. You all worked so hard. And it's like, that seems like blasphemous. They'd rather still keep an appearance being like, no, there's never a humanizing moment with them. Is that still very prevalent in the leadership field?
You know, it's so interesting because I think that I don't have any data to back this up. So this is completely anecdotal. I think that during the pandemic, there was sort of a pendulum swinging to like the more human leader, the empathetic leader. And why? I mean, literally, the universe, I can use that term with you, right? Like the universe forced us to all be human, right? Because nobody was immune for a period of time. Nobody was protected from this thing. So everybody saw each other as human, right? And so it was sort of like, well, you better be human as a leader. Like you've got to show some empathy here or you're probably going to get canceled, right? And then like, as we moved away from that era, and I was actually really curious around how much of this was going to stick, okay? And my hypothesis was not strong that it was going to stick. And I think my hypothesis is proving true, all right? Where it has swung back to the other side, which is now we just need to get things done. And, you know, there's so much to unpack around what is the need for that. I think at the end of the day, it is a need to demonstrate power and authority and control rather than embody power and authority and control. Okay. Those who feel confident around the power that they hold, around the authority that they hold, around the control that they hold, do not have to show it, do not have to hold this aura. They actually can basically just be and they're fine, you know? And those who have to, and we have some examples, I will not name them, but we have some very public examples in our world right now of those who have to be seen in this godlike, you know, huge aura type of image, because there is a fear that underlies that, right? And the fear is that they will not be seen as that. So they have to show it even more, hoping that people don't see through it, you know? So it's kind of like the emperor has no clothes on type of situation. There's so much wisdom in that story, you know? That's what it is. And I will tell you, when I have clients like that, to be honest, I sleep very well at night. And so what they say, I mean, I actually had a client like that who was this, I know I'm right. Like that was the thing. And at some point I said, look, are you okay being experienced the way that you're being experienced in the organization? And he's like, yep, pretty much. And I said, and are you okay experiencing yourself that way? And he was like, yeah. And I said, well, then we're done. We don't need to be doing this work. Right? Because if you're getting the results, it's the way that you're showing up in the world as a leader and nobody's holding you accountable because his boss was fine with the way he was showing up. It was everybody else who couldn't stand it, right? People were leaving left and right, but they just kept hiring people. What are we going to do? You're not ready. You know, you're not ready. And as you know, some people are never ready and that's okay, right? You cannot change anything, an organization, a culture, an individual, anything, until there is a level of readiness. And that level of readiness needs to come from within.
I'd say it comes from within, but also you've noticed that the pandemic, they had to, when the external forces started realizing, oh yeah, those little blockers you have are now costing a lot of money.
That's right. That's right. Well, I would say that when it comes from the external, it's not necessarily sustainable, or else this pendulum would not have swung back, right? So you just are responding at the moment, but it doesn't necessarily stick.
We got a couple more I want to cover. But before that, you know, for someone who's listening to this podcast, they're in a leadership position. What are the itches that they should be paying attention to that makes them go, hey, I really need to look at this right now? Because in some organization, they might be like, listen, we're just driving sales. Our culture's toxic, but we need to hit these numbers or we're going bankrupt. They're probably going to be like, okay, this is not a right now book. What are the usual formulas and states that you're in as a company that you're like, holy crap, this is my biggest thing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, most of my work, or all of my work, quite frankly, is not done at the systems level, right? At the overall company level. It's done one by one, individual by individual, with my hope being that, you know, as every individual does the work, it creates a collective shift, right? But I think it's really simple. I think it is whenever you feel a level of dissonance, you know, and what does that mean? There's a gap between what it is that you want and what's actually happening, right? There's the dissonance. It is the ability in those moments, and that can be in external results, right? My team isn't acting right. People aren't doing what they're supposed to do. I didn't get promoted. I got feedback that I wasn't expecting. The company is not doing well. Two, something internal dissonance. I'm not feeling motivated, and I expect myself to be motivated. I'm not feeling energized. I'm feeling burned out when I don't want to feel burned out. So there is a level of dissonance. And I think, so first, it's noticing the dissonance. And then secondly, it is rather than focusing or asking what is wrong with everything around me that is creating this dissonance, right? Which is what I did when you look at the story I share in my book. Rather than looking on the outside, it's looking at yourself and saying, in what way am I contributing to this dissonance? Because every dynamic is co-created, right? And it's not just looking at your actions and your behaviors. It's saying, okay, how am I contributing in terms of my actions? But then taking it one step further and asking, what are the beliefs that I'm holding, or what is the belief that I'm holding that is contributing to the behavior that is then creating this dissonance or these outcomes? And here's the reason why, right? Let me drop a little bit of science behind this. There was a really interesting study done. This is just one data point. Really interesting study done by Elia Crum out of Stanford, I believe. And she looked at hotel attendants, okay? And she said, okay, hotel attendants, I mean, we've all seen them. They're pushing things around. They're moving around all day. They're on their feet, etc. And they asked these hotel attendants, do you consider the work that you do exercise? And they said, no, this isn't exercise. This is my job. I do my work. That's it, okay? They said, all right. For the next couple of weeks, they took a group. They said, we want you to think about your work as exercise. That's the only change they made. Think about your work as exercise. Consider your work exercise. Only a belief. Believe that your work is exercise. Compared to the group where they did not ask them to do that, they saw significant enough improvements in a number of different health metrics in the ones that believed that their work was exercise. They did their work no differently than the other group. The only thing that changed is how they thought about their work. So what did this show? Elia Crum concluded that in order to achieve a change in results, it's not about only doing something differently. It's also about what we think about what we do that leads to the difference in results. And my thinking was, well, why can't this be applied when it comes to leadership? And so here lies, to me, the case for if you want different results, don't just do differently. You've also got to think differently about what it is that you do.
Well, I think just by listening to this episode and getting the privilege of speaking with you, I already am getting a chance to think of all the responsibilities I hold by actually having this list of blockers to review. And I'm acutely curious to go deeper into how this pops up into my life. I'm going to list another one here, which is, if I can do it, so can you. And this one When you delegate a task 100%, you expect the person who has taken on the task to deliver it at the same level of percentage, 100% as you? Would that be the assumption?
Yeah. I mean, this one was the wild card, Jason. I was surprised by this one, right? I mean, the others, I was kind of like, oh, yeah, like, I get it, right? This one I was surprised with. Why? Because it's so often used in like motivational, inspirational type of talk. You think about what mentoring is, right? An apprenticeship model you talked about in sales, which very much holds an apprenticeship model. It's like, follow me, shadow me, do everything that I do, and therefore you too will be a great salesperson, right? And that's not to say that it doesn't apply, again, in certain circumstances, but where it can really get in the way is in understanding how to coach people based on the capacity and the commitment that they have. If we're assuming that their starting place is the same starting place as us, we are missing the boat, right? And so, you know, what strikes me here is that, yeah, you can assume that somebody can do exactly what you do, but inherent in that assumption is that their story since day one has been exactly the same as yours, right? And we all know that that's not the case. You know, what we need to understand is, what is this person's motivation? What is this person's capacity? What is their baseline of skills? What is their commitment, their level of confidence, etc.? And then based on that, if I'm a leader, right, my responsibility is to say, okay, based on that, how do I move them from point A to point B? How do I coach them and develop them? And it could be that your way is the way, but don't assume that your way is the only way.
I've always had this mantra I would tell myself is, whenever I delegate a task, I can only expect 75 to 80% of the same speed or quality of result as if I would do it myself, but I get to do so much more because so many more people are involved. Would that be a correct approach, or are there even some flaws in those assumptions?
I mean, I think there could be a flaw, because look, there are some things that I delegate, you know, where the person does 120% what I could do. You know, a rule of thumb for me is, I outsource anything where I absolutely know that somebody else or a particular person or a particular team would do it way better than I could ever do it. Okay, there's other reasons why I would outsource, but that is one of my metrics. And so a very good example is why I have house cleaners. You know, they can do it way better than I ever could, even if I spent a week on it, and they do it faster and more efficiently. And they add way more value there than I could ever add. It's not just about you being able to do better. Sometimes they can do better. Doesn't matter. The whole point is that there is not one way of doing anything. And when you start instituting that, again, from a leadership perspective, what it stunts is growing the capacity of your people, okay? And that, again, is a leadership responsibility. Your responsibility, regardless of the size of the organization, is to grow capacity of the organization, to create an organization that doesn't solely rely on you or your way, but that actually increases capacity for problem solving, for innovation, for creativity, for being able to get to the results. So if your way is the only way, where's the growth in that?
And I find myself, as I said that statement, I'm like, wow, you know, there's definitely, this is not the case all the time. And my easiest example is to think of my happiness every time I hire a designer, because I suck at design. I can go into Canva, I can put together a slide and it'll look cute. But every time I have a designer go in and they just make it, chef's kiss, it brings me a joy. And I'm like, I think this was the right move.
That's right. That's right.
It's very
tangible. That's right. That's right. Exactly.
So the last two blockers, they don't seem to be as tied to results. They seem to be very individualized. And the first one being that I can't say no. Sounds like if you're in a leadership position that still is reporting to somebody higher that has external demands on you, and assuming that everything that they say, you just have to take on and run with it, not question it. Is that the blocker?
Yeah, it is. And it can not only be from people who are higher than you, it could be from clients. It can even be from your team, right? I've run into situations where this is actually a very real one intergenerationally, right? Where, you know, my generation, I was born in the early 70s. And so my generation, like, we never asked for anything from our organizations and our boss. They told us what to do, you know, jump this high. We're like, how high do we need to jump? Whereas, you know, the new generation has more agency and they ask for things and they expect things. And there's a real dissonance where, particularly with leaders who I can't say no, because they feel this tension of like, I've got to give my team everything that they want, right? Which is not possible. It actually is still tied to results, Jason. If you recall, I said leadership really is about two things. It's about the tasks and those results, but also about the people. The I can't say no is more worried about the people results. And so grounding it is a fear of losing connection in the relational aspect of leadership. Because all of these blockers, when they are not serving us right, are getting in the way because they're grounded in three fears, right? Three fears that are substantiated by three universal human needs that we have. We all have a need for connection. We all have a need for safety. We all have a need to feel worthy, right? Or if you really carry it a step further in the Mind Valley language, it would be a need to feel loved, right? And so when you look at those three things, you know, when we look at the I can't say no, it's this fear of losing connection, of being kicked out of the tribe if you say no, you know. And so it still is grounded in results, but it's not necessarily the task results. It's the relational results that are part of the job.
I would have a feeling you coach the people that might struggle with setting boundaries, being disliked, being a people pleaser. That seems to be where this one comes up.
Yeah, that's how it manifests itself, right? But it's very hard to just tell somebody, well, you just need, you know, this is why I get a little frustrated, because it's like, you know, people say, you just need to set some boundaries. Well, you know, damn it. Like, if I could set boundaries, I would have done it a long time ago. And guess what? Guess what got me here? What got me here was not setting boundaries, right? Everybody loved me because I didn't set boundaries, because I took care of everything. I took care of everyone and everything and solved all the problems so you didn't have to. And that's what got me to this place. And now you're telling me I need to set boundaries, or I'm so burned out, right, that I can't physically do my job and take care of everyone, or I've burned my team out and now I need to set boundaries. But how the heck do I do that if I still have this little voice in my head that's telling me I can't say no?
Well, there's where getting that one done now is definitely not going to be the case. I think that's the most concrete example that gets you to understand this will require some patience and work. And I guess, you know, that's why there's an entire coaching industry, because these things take time and need support. And as behaviors and mindsets that we've trained to succeed in that way, and now we need to update those models, it takes some time and energy.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely.
Now we're coming full circle, and I'm so glad you've been open enough to share some of the key things from the book. And again, I'm going to put a link for those who want to dive deep, because you'll want to fully diagnose and see how you can change these beliefs, which gets covered into the book. But the last one, I found this one interesting. So I'll just read the title and I'll let you unpack it, which is, I don't belong here.
Mm-hmm.
What's up with that?
Yeah. You know, this one is, a lot of people are like, oh, is that the imposter syndrome thing? Which I have a little bit of issue with that word, right? With that terminology, because at the end of the day, it's like imposter syndrome or imposter is really the part that I take issue with, because it's like, well, what are you imposing on, you know? But what it points to is this belief of I don't belong here, the belief that I'm actually imposing. You're only imposing on something if you're not supposed to be there. Okay. And so for many of my clients, like, they got promoted, they got the job, they were asked to the meeting, and yet they carry this thing of not believing that they are supposed to be there, that then gets in their way of actually showing up fully in the deserving, worthy role that they have. Now, here's the thing. The workplace, for any of these, by the way, are not where all of a sudden you have this belief, right? It has been there for a long time. So a lot of times where I see this particular belief is for individuals who, quite frankly, for most of their life have felt like they were on the outside, like they had to prove themselves to be someplace. A lot of times it's in underrepresented groups, but it could also be with people. You know, I had one client where she was the only one in her family, and, you know, I share some of her story in the book, like, who went to college, you know, and having to then be around everybody who, and she did not go to an Ivy League school, but she ended up working in places where most of the people who were there went to Ivy League school. So she always kind of felt on this outside where she was sort of trying to get her way in. But then when she finally made it to a very senior level position, was asked to be at all these things, she was still carrying that story in. So it's not to say that that story isn't true. It's that, is that story serving you in this capacity? Right. And in her case, it wasn't. Okay. And so being able to understand that there's a difference between belonging somewhere and being accepted somewhere. You hold the power of belonging anywhere. And in my opinion, if you're physically at the table or if you're at the thing, you belong. Like, what's the question? Now, whether they accept you or not is a whole different story. Right. But you belong. Okay. Even that shift kind of creates a difference for some of my clients who deal with this belief.
The way I was thinking of this blocker was in a case where somebody who's very technically expertise gets promoted into a much more managerial position, and now their whole set of priorities and what they need to focus on is a lot more people than things, is where something like this would be triggered.
It could, absolutely. It's whenever somebody feels, you know, like, this does not feel familiar to me. So in that particular case, it's like, these are not the skills that I'm used to. It would be more productive to think about it that way. These are the skills that I'm not used to versus I don't belong here. What happens in those moments? Like, why does somebody jump to I don't belong here instead of these are not the skills I'm used to? It's because the feeling that they have, the feeling of looking around and feeling like, oh my gosh, is actually triggering a memory of a time when they did not feel like they belonged. So the memory might feel similar, but the situation is different. And this is where it gets to, a lot of these beliefs are grounded in memories, right? They did not start today. They started a long time ago. And I'm not a therapist, so I know enough, but I am not in the business of going back with my clients and really trying to unpack what happened in the past. That is for the therapist. I'm very clear about the boundary between coaching and therapy, right? And we cannot ignore that the beliefs that somebody brings into work and bring into their leadership roles have an impact in terms of how they behave. We cannot compartmentalize that the beliefs that they formed when they were younger, or when they went through schooling, or as young adults, or with their early jobs, are not impacting the way they show up now as a, you know, 40-something, 50-something, name the age, it doesn't matter, executive. That is, you live in a magical fantasy world if you think that. And so part of this is understanding that we have to stop expecting people to sort of leave all of that on the outside, and rather understand that they come in with it. And rather than it causing havoc, let's try to get them to understand how they can coach themselves so that they have more agency over their beliefs and can have a more positive impact on everybody else.
Mariel, this has been a fascinating conversation where you might have expected that by having a conversation about leadership would have been very focused on how you can get others to do things for you, whereas this whole conversation was about how do we look inside ourselves to make it so that the results are multiplied much, much more, less chaos, more harmony, more results. And quite honestly, it sounds like you've just provided a blueprint that will make people better leaders in the workplace, but also probably a lot more peace in their personal lives as well. So it seems very comprehensive, very actionable, and I'm very glad that we got to go through all these blockers. I want to make sure for everybody listening in that we want to make sure you get yourself a copy. The book has just come out, Leadership Unblocked, Breakthrough the Beliefs That Limit Your Potential. And I'd be curious to know, you've put in all the work into putting this book together. What is the hope result that you have from people picking up this book, getting into the masses? What is the ripple that'll come from this work?
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, it's the same hope that I have in the work that I do and what drives me. You know, my hope is that when people understand that they have much more in control than they give themselves credit to, with the main source being their mind and themselves and how they can control that, that it will open up the path for them to recognize that they can lead with more ease. And my hope is that as leaders lead with more ease, it will just create ease for everyone else. And boy, wouldn't that make the world a better place?
Gosh, we need it right now. Thank you. Thank you for bringing your work forward. Thank you for coming on the show and sharing with everyone so generously. And for everybody tuning in, hey, we need a lot more leaders in the world. There's no reason it can't be you, and you have a blueprint here on what to work for. So make sure to pick up a copy. And Mirielle, once again, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Jason. It really was a great experience.
Thank you for listening to the Jason Mark Campbell Business Podcast. And of course, keep selling with love.
If you're like most professionals I know, you've built a successful career, but you're still wondering if you're making the smartest moves with your money. That's where Mezy comes in. It's the AI-powered platform for tax strategies, investment insights, and clear action steps. No confusing reports, just answers, without spending thousands a year. Thousands of tech professionals, doctors, and other higher earners are using Mezy to manage serious wealth. Go to Mezy.com and see what modern wealth building looks like. That's M-E-Z-Z-I.com.